Welcome to this edition of Shelf Interest, the library podcast brought to you by the Maine Library. I'm Cheryl.
And I'm Laura.
And we're here with great book recommendations for you. So Laura, what are you reading?
Well, I just finished a book by Rebecca Conley called A Brilliant Night of Stars and Ice, and it is about the Titanic, and it's told from different perspectives from other Titanic stories. It's told in alternating chapters. One storyline is from a survivor of the Titanic disaster and how that night unfolds for her and her friends, and the other alternating chapter is from the perspective of the captain of the Carpathia, the ship that came to save those survivors of that disaster.
Oh.
And so, you know, when you read books about the Titanic, you know how that story ends. And you know all of the famous high marks of that story. You know about the band that played on the deck. You know about all the rich and famous people who passed. You know that there were not enough lifeboats for all the people on that ship. You know that more than 1,500 people perished in that disaster. And of the more than 700 that survived, you know about some of the more popular people like the unsinkable Molly Brown and people like that. What you don't often hear about is from the perspective of people who were on the ship that rescued them. And they were on a journey on their own. And the minute that they heard the CDQ distress signal from the Titanic, the Marconi operator woke the captain. He said, "All hands on deck. We'll do what we have to do to save people, even at great risk to ourselves." And so that is what they did. But it took them some hours to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I just find it interesting that the human side of people who decide to put all of their needs and wants and intentions aside and to do what's necessary to save other people, that concept of humankind just really fascinates me. But the story of the young Irish girl on the ship, her name is Kate Conley. And it turns out there were two Kate Conleys on that ship from Ireland.
Hmm.
And she was a real person on the Titanic. Even though this is a fictionalized account, she was a real person on that ship. Not much is known about her, except that she was leaving Ireland to go live with her sister in America. And she was with friends on that ship, young women in their 20s going to America for a new start. And they met other young people on that ship. And it made me really think about the movie Titanic with Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio. When she talks about there were parties in the third class area.
Mm-hmm.
These people were on an adventure and a new life and looking to really change their future. And then this tragedy happens, and not all of the people she met on that ship made it off. Some of them, they got separated in the boats, they never saw again. And of course, the young men that she might have met on that ship that were also going to America for a new life were not able to get in lifeboats.
Right.
But her tragedy was that when they got on the Carpathia and they were keeping track of names and things of who survived, there were two Kate Conleys. And she was originally marked as not being a survivor, and the other Kate Conley was.
Oh, so the family got notified the wrong thing?
So the other Kate Conley's family have been told, yes, your loved one is on the Carpathia. She will be in New York on this date. And the Kate Conley, whose perspective we learn about, her sister is told that she did not survive.
Oh, no.
And so she has this deep and abiding conflict within her about it's not her mistake, but how this mistake is going to impact one family in a terribly negative way. But then her sister who thinks she has died, she's going to show up on her doorstep in New York City and get the shock of her life. And so that's a really interesting story. And you've mm-hmm. heard a lot of stories like that coming out of the Titanic from passengers and things. I'm struck by seeing the Titanic disaster from a ship who came to their rescue. That mm-hmm. is the part that really stuck with me. And when Captain Arthur Rostron, who was the real captain of the Carpathia, he wrote a book in the 1930s about his experience at sea, and in particular with that. When he addressed his men on board to thank them for what they had done, he was so proud of them. And there were passengers that stood around and listened to that speech. And he basically said and thought to himself, you know, we're going to be a footnote in history, that people are going to remember the scope of this tragedy for what happened to the people on the Titanic, and they won't remember us. And I'm just so glad when I find books like this that take stories like that, that you know are out there, that you might not have been exposed to because of the salaciousness of all the other details of that tragedy, that you find goodness in human spirit and goodness in people willing to do the right thing at great cost to themselves. They traveled through that ice field full speed, as fast as that ship could go. And he talks about...
And so they could have... Right. Met the same fate.
Right. And he talks about how every man stayed awake. They had one Marconi operator, and that poor guy was awake for 3 days straight. He's the only one that could run
run the radio.
That's right, run that radio. And everybody was all hands on deck the whole time. And, you know, when you're traveling through an ice field that's 5 miles long, 5 miles long, you better have all hands on deck, because he talks about how that ship was going above what they'd ever gotten her up to speed-wise, and that you could hear it creaking.
Ooh.
And when it was all over and they got ready to resume their normal, you know, passage again, he talked about what a great ship that was. And in fact, not part of the story, but in the afterword of the story, the book, the author talks about how the Carpathia was eventually converted to help during the war. World War I, and it was sunk by a German U-boat.
Oh,
and
man.
When Arthur Rostron heard that, I mean, he said, well, that's an unfitting end to a ship that worthy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, it's a powerful story. And there are other great Titanic books out there, but this one really struck at me. And like
wow.
I said, when you read historical fiction, you know what the ending is.
Yeah.
Because you've heard all those details, and there have been so many books written about this topic. But when you look at the personal aspect, there are hundreds of those that we still haven't heard.
It becomes more than just
exactly.
dates and
exactly.
something you read in a yeah. you know, your textbooks. It
and
becomes
the farther
real.
In history we get removed from events like this, the less people know and remember about it. And I think books like this keep the memory of those things fresh in all of our minds.
Mm, that sounds interesting.
So what are you reading, Cheryl?
Well, I'm actually kind of in the middle of two different books, one that I'm reading and one that I'm listening to. I've been on a perfume kick lately. I got really into perfume during lockdown. So I'm reading one nonfiction book and one fiction, which is historical, which you'll like. The first one is Perfume, A Century of Scents by Lizzie Ostrom. And what she does is she takes the 20th century, and for each decade, she picks out 10 perfumes or colognes or whatever that she thinks kind of typifies the trends going on in culture at that time. And some of these may be still made today, and they've survived the test of times. And some of them, you know, they only lasted for a few years. But they're quirky little, you know, 2 or 3 page little essays about one perfume or one cologne and how it fits into society and what was going on at the time and why some of them have lasted and why some of them haven't. I mean, did you know that Old Spice was first released in 1937?
No.
Yeah, 1937.
I remember back in the day, like, you didn't have much to pick from. Men didn't have much to pick from when it came to deodorant.
Mm-hmm.
But Old Spice was the one that all the men in my family always wore.
That's what we always bought for my dad, too, because
yeah.
I liked it. And it's not in this book, but I have read somewhere else that Old Spice was actually initially released as a female perfume.
Really?
Yeah. because in the 1930s, there was, it wasn't all flowers and stuff. There was a rebellious attitude. So the spiciness was first thought that it would appeal toward women, but the women were buying it for their, you know, significant others, their husbands, their fathers, and things like that. And so they rebranded and remarketed it as men's, and it's stayed that way since. And now it's come full circle because, you know, the commercials now, the woman is actually, you know, stealing her husband's Old Spice. Because it's, I mean, it is now what we consider unisex, actually. So the other one I'm reading, or actually listening to, is an audiobook called The Perfume Collector by Kathleen Tesoro, and I'm listening to this one while I'm doing gardening. So it's an audiobook, and you'd like it because it's, you know, just it's post World War II England, so it's in the 50s, and it's about a lady named Grace who was raised in Oxford in a scholarly town, but she marries into society, a rich man, and she's having trouble and adjusting to the shallowness and all of that. And she and her husband hit a rocky patch. And just about right that time, she gets a letter from a law firm in Paris saying that she is named as the beneficiary in the will of a woman named Ava Dorsey. And they sent her a plane ticket and says, come to Paris, you know, to settle the estate. And she's like, I don't know who this is. She has no idea who this woman is.
Wow.
But because she's hit a rocky patch with her marriage, she goes ahead and gets on the plane. And then it flips back to Ava's point of view from when she was a 15-year-old girl in the 1920s. And it tells the story of the two women alternating viewpoints and flashbacks, of course, in Ava's point of view, because Ava is the one who died. And it turns out that she had gotten involved in perfume collecting, and she had been the muse for some perfumers who actually created perfumes based on her. And Grace gets led to this, when she gets the inheritance letter, she gets led to this perfume shop, and she's got to investigate and find out about Ava and how this woman knows her and how all of this fits into her life. And so it's the story of the two women, you know, separated by decades, but tied together and trying to find their way.
Yeah. I love stories like that. I think that's what I like so much about historical fiction, is so many books have alternating storylines where one is contemporary and one is about what happened during that period. My second book that I wanted to share was called, it's called The Baker's Secret by Stephen Kiernan. And as Cheryl, as you mentioned, Cheryl, probably my favorite time period to read about is World War II and post-World War II. I've read a lot of things about that time period. And given that we just had the anniversary of D-Day, The Baker's Secret is perfect timing. Because it's about a young girl who, at the age of 13, she lives in Normandy, France. She becomes an apprentice to the town's baker, and he is Jewish. And so eventually, as German troops enter their territory, they start rounding up Jewish people and taking them away, and she's left in this bakery all by herself. Now, she's a young woman at this point, but she's not married. And she's been apprenticing as a baker for almost 10 years. And so when the Germans come to town, they not only do they round up the Jews and take them away, never to be seen again, they also start encroaching on everyone's livestock and food supplies to take care of their soldiers first, with little regard for the village people and the other human beings that live there. And so this young baker, Emma, finds herself in a spot where she's baking bread for this German commandant and his troops because they love her bread. But she's seeing that all of her family and friends and the townspeople are slowly starving to death because of what is happening with the war and the food situation. And so what she figures out a way to do is something that many people who helped in small and large ways in the resistance, she figured out a way to create every day 2 extra loaves of bread from the supplies given that she was allowed to have because she was baking for German soldiers. And so she would pilfer off a little bit of all of the ingredients, and then she figured out how to grind up straw and add to the dough. And every day, at risk to her life, she made 2 extra loaves of bread and then did her little part to help feed some of her people who were suffering the most. And those are things that, while they loved her bread, it could have got her killed. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And so those were very dangerous things that people did. And it may seem like nothing, 2 loaves of bread a day couldn't go very far. But when you think about all the people during that time period that were working
little
subversively,
things, little things
right.
add up if little, there's enough people.
Little things, big things, at great risk to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the story resolves itself. The townspeople are sure that the Allies are eventually going to land and help them. But Emma has gotten to the point where she just doesn't believe it anymore, because how could the rest of the world continue to let this happen? And so finally, you know how this happens in history, too. You know what happened on D-Day.
Right.
You know how World War II ended. But it doesn't make the story any less thrilling and tense, you know, because...
Mm-hmm.
because
but you don't know what happened to these
right.
people that you're invested
right.
in.
And I think what fascinates me also, Cheryl, is that that's one story. That's one idea of someone making a tiny difference. And imagine how many more are out there that we don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
And I just hope that people continue writing these stories and come bringing to light the ways that people work to help defeat the Germans.
Wow. Intense. Okay, so my last book that I'm going to be featuring is also kind of intense. And it's also about somebody who helps. And it's called Healing: When a Nurse Becomes a Patient, by Teresa Brown. This one is a memoir. Now, this one's nonfiction, so it's actually a true story. It's written by a woman who is a nurse and is still a nurse. And it follows her story from the time that she gets diagnosed with cancer for the first year of her treatment. Follows her through chemotherapy and all the decisions she has to make and everything of that. And she is suddenly getting, she knows the medical industry from the point of view of a nurse, but now she's suddenly getting this in-depth, you know, hit it home, hard look at how the medical industry is for seriously ill patients. And so she's got a really good reading, easily read style. So it's not like, oh, numbers and dates and all of this. It's little stories from when she was a home healthcare nurse. It's little stories about the people she helps and then what happens. And it's flashbacks that kind of juxtapose her situation with the other patients mm-hmm. that she saw from the other point of view. And so she's shedding a light on not only the patient care, but the current state of the insurance industry in America. And you don't realize how much of your medical treatment is actually dictated to the doctors
yeah.
by the insurance companies and what they will pay for. Because there's no way that the patients can pay for some of these things by themselves. I know, you know, none of us could. And so if the insurance companies won't pay, they don't get the treatment. So it's being dictated to the doctors. And so it's kind of heart-wrenching in a way, but there's little kind of joy in some of her stories. Mm-hmm. In the middle of all of that.
Hope.
Yeah, there's little bits of hope and joy in the other patients that she's continuing to treat before and after her own illness.
Yeah.
So I think it's a really fascinating read.
Well, and it's interesting that you bring that up. Another book that I had recently read is by Sherry Fink, and it's a nonfiction account of what happened during Katrina at Memorial Hospital in New Orleans. It's called 5 Days at Memorial. And it details, much as you said, it's a very strict timeline of exactly what happened through all mm-hmm. of the accounts. And I go back to, much like the Titanic, I remember, obviously, when Katrina happened, I remember the images that I kept seeing on TV. I remember all of the squabbling after the fact with the fault finding with the mayor and the governor and all the FEMA officials. I remember that. I remember the images of people on their roofs waiting to be rescued from boats and helicopters. And I do remember some talk about nursing, what was happening in nursing homes and hospitals, mm-hmm. That when power failed, then they couldn't get these elderly people out.
Evacuated, right.
But I guess I did not realize the extent to which some of these agencies went to make this life-changing decisions for people. And so 5 Days at Memorial outlines literally 5 days leading up to and after the hurricane. And it's, even though it's a nonfiction and it's really written in a very date-oriented, interview-oriented style, it's very tense because they document watching the water rise and get closer and closer to this hospital. And they had, at one point, had the opportunity to get some federal money to move the generator for the hospital out of the lowest part of the building and didn't. And I go back to what you said about healthcare companies making decisions about some of the care that we get. So their home base, their home office for this hospital was somewhere in Texas. And people in Texas were making decisions about what was going to happen at this hospital in Katrina.
And they weren't in a floodplain.
And they weren't there. They did not know how dire it was. And I just, part of me gets so mad when I read a book like that. But of course, that's hindsight. Mm-hmm. And then you've got to remember that the entire city was struggling with rescuing people, not just from this hospital, but nursing homes and all the other hospitals. But they spent 5 days in a hospital with no power, no flushing toilets, and they probably treated this as, you know, well, I'm going to bring my family here to the hospital and be with me, so at least we could be together. And then people brought their pets. And you have a hospital with thousands of people and their dogs, and food was not a problem. They had plenty of food. A lot of people that came to stay there brought food, and the hospital was well-stocked with food.
But no toilets.
No way to get those animals outside.
And no electricity.
No electricity, and it's hot. And they had to make, the hospital staff had to make difficult decisions about who's going to get treated when you have to bag people by hand because your generator's out, and you have a lot of people that need to be bagged nonstop. You have to make tough decisions. And
like,
you know,
triage during the war.
Yes, like triage during the war. But with all of the advancement in technology and healthcare, that's what it came to. That's what breaks your heart so much, you know. And I would read one chapter for a point of view where here's why we decided to not treat this person. And another point of view is here's why we should have treated this person. And you had medical people with differing opinions. And then, you know, just the response was that hospital had, I want to say it was something like 19 different emergency plans. If this happens, this is what we do. If this happened, they did not have a plan for what happens if you don't have a generator. And again, it's hindsight. But shame on them if they didn't learn anything. It's hard when someone is in another state and is not listening to the wind and watching the water rise and understanding the absolute dire consequences that are facing you. And it's shocking that in the United States of America in 2005, that this sort of thing can happen.
Mm-hmm.
But we keep demonstrating over and over that it can. But it was a riveting read. And then it follows up with what happened after Katrina and the medical professionals that they did charge with varying degrees of felonies and how that played out.
Wow. It sounds like all the ones that we're recommending today are all kind of emotionally pulling you in. Maybe next time we should
we'll do
a little
uplifting.
More fluffy.
Yeah, we'll do
a little more happy. Oh, yeah, because these all sound interesting and emotionally intriguing. But
things we should all learn from.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, thank you for joining us. We'll be back again soon for more great recommendations on our next episode. This project is made possible by the State Library of Kansas and the Institute of Museum and Library Services. Thanks for listening. Bye.